Hey, good afternoon to you, or according to where you are, good morning, or happy wee small hours. It's 4 p.m. Eastern Time in North America. That means it's 5 p.m. in Canada's Atlantic provinces, 5:30 p.m. in Newfoundland and Labrador, 6 p.m. for all you Uyghurs listening in Bermuda. It is 9 p.m. Greenwich Mean Time, 10 p.m. in Western Europe, 11 p.m. in Cairo, midnight in Moscow, the dark hours of the night in most of Asia, and an early morning in Australia and New Zealand. Wherever you are, welcome along to our last Clubland Q&A before Christmas. A week from today, it's going to be Christmas Day. And if you haven't yet got the ideal present for your loved one, it may be waiting at the Stein store. We have some of our Steinemite Christmas specials. If you really want to splash out, you could treat your near and dear ones to a couple of tickets for my shows with Dennis Miller if you happen to be in the Pennsylvania and upstate central western New York area, or indeed southern Ontario. Or you could come and join us on the Mark Stein cruise, because we've also got staterooms available for that. We're talking about some of the issues today that came up on my appearances with Tucker on TV and on America's number one radio show. I was guest hosting for Rush yesterday. And but we're also going to be, if you've got any sort of year-endy type thoughts on where we are now versus where we were 12 months ago, then do shoot me a question. Chris Hall is first up. In the grand world of Brexit, might not the best option for those levers of powerlessness be to just try to gum up the works until the clock runs out and a hard Brexit happens by inaction? Of course, people in the UK and Europe don't really have true clocks in the sports sense, e.g. footy, so I suspect that the ref will signal a few years of stoppage time. It's interesting. Apparently, the cabinet in the United Kingdom met today and decided that they were going to focus their efforts and indeed some money on preparing for a hard Brexit, i.e. on that day in March the 29th, Britain just crashes out of the European Union and becomes like the 170 countries around the world that are not in the European Union and just trades with the EU bloc on a World Trade Organization basis. And I think that's actually, I think that's best, better than the alternatives. Obviously, the United Kingdom is different from, Papua New Guinea, in that it's a lot nearer the European mainland, and it shares a land border with Mr. Varadkar's little Brussels-friendly Dublin statelet, Dublin fiefdom. So obviously, they're going to be compelling reasons eventually for Britain and the European Union to have some kind of closer relationship than, as I said, Papua New Guinea does with the European Union. But those will come. They're in both parties' interests once they're separated. It's like, and that's the word to use, it's like divorce court. And it's all very fractious and all the rest of it. And the judge says in family court to a husband and wife in Splitsville, it's bad now, but it's going to get better. And it doesn't always get better, but sometimes it does get better. Because once all the poison's out of the system, there are various practical ways that one can intersect and do things together. But that's not going to happen between now and March. And Mrs. May has come up with a deal that is absolutely appalling, that is actually worse than staying in the EU. And it would be better, I think, just to crash out. But the betrayal, the subversion of Brexit this last couple of years is actually very revealing of a rotted state in democracy in the United Kingdom. The contempt for the voice of the people demonstrated in the last 2 years is interesting. And also, as I've said before, the feeble paralysis that a country, whatever you feel about British imperialism, whatever you feel about modern Britain, a country that has been responsible for writing more constitutions, dozens and dozens and dozens of them, for all kinds of places, all around the planet, somehow, we don't know what to do now. Oh, my goodness, we haven't negotiated a trade agreement since the 70s. What are we meant to do? Oh, look at this. There's a border in Ireland. What are we meant to make of that? It's all rubbish, that. It's all rubbish, and it's unbecoming to a great nation. I'm in favour of hard Brexit. A hard Brexit is necessary, I think, because right now the state the European Union is in, the European Union's interests in this are very specific. It cannot afford for Britain to be a success, to make a go of Brexit. In other words, it has to teach Britain that Brexit is a failure. It has to make Brexit a disaster. And it can only do that by being in on the deal. And by the way, I don't disagree with Brussels on that. I think if you've gone to all the trouble of constructing a European Union, the last thing you want is a major player exiting and demonstrating that it can do so and make a go of it. What's that going to do to all kinds of people around the EU who are just a little bit antsy about it and are thinking that it maybe doesn't make quite as much sense as it used to? As I always say, the EU is a 1970s solution to a 1940s problem. If some of those Central and Eastern European states see that Brexit works, maybe they'll start thinking about quitting the EU. So it is necessary, if you're a Brussels bureaucrat, it's necessary that Brexit be a big stinking failure that hangs around the neck of the British and teaches the other 27 members, this is what happens when you try to go against us. That makes perfect sense from Brussels' point of view, which is why they shouldn't be in on the deal. It's much better to just crash out and then rebuild the relationship when both parties have sobered up and got some perspective on it. And this idea that, you won't be able to fly out of the country, planes won't be able to land in Europe, Mars bars, we won't have the ingredients to make, it's all nonsense. It's drivel. The idea that somehow it's going to be a country under siege, people will be starving, they'll be looting, they'll be pillaging, there'll be riots in the street. How stupid do the globalist elites have to think the masses are to peddle that kind of nonsense? Hard Brexit, bring it on, bring it on. It's the easiest thing. Mike writes, why would anyone in their right mind ever talk to or assist the FBI now? Perhaps the field agents are good people, but the fish rots from the head down. This is in reference, I guess, not just to General Flynn, whose sentencing was postponed today. General Flynn was visited by Peter Strzok and another FBI agent. Peter Strzok, as I said on Rush, is the Forrest Gump of the FBI. There's 35,000 employees in the FBI, but Peter Strzok is everywhere. He's in the middle of the Clinton investigation. He flies to London to set up the Papadopoulos thing. He's, apart from the Clinton investigation, he's also doing the Russian investigation. Then when Robert Mueller is appointed, he transfers to the special counsel investigation. He does everything. I don't know why they need the other 35,000 guys. Why don't they just let them go and just have Peter Strzok to do everything? Because that seems to be what's happening anyway. Michael Flynn and Papadopoulos both pleaded guilty to these process crimes. And as I said on Rush, and I got some pushback from it from liberal ninnies who thought it was a tribalism thing, that a process crime isn't a crime. Murder is a crime. Rape is a crime. Parking in a handicapped person's parking spot when you don't have a handicap sticker is a crime. But a process crime isn't a crime. It just means they can get you on something for which there is no underlying crime. That's how the FBI got Martha Stewart sent to jail, which shouldn't have happened either. And that is why, actually, when you say, why would anyone talk to the FBI now? That's what Mike says. Lawyers actually don't like their clients talking to the FBI? Because when people say, oh, I think there might be something criminal going on, I'm going to go and see the FBI about it, their lawyers always say to them, you ought to think twice about that because you'll misremember a date and then the FBI will get you on the crime of misremembering and you'll suddenly be the one in trouble. I said on Rush that if someone from the FBI wants to come round and interview you, as they did with Flynn, Flynn should have recorded it. Everyone thinks that they can handle these sort of quasi-judicial interviews. And you see incredibly naive people always say, oh, well, if you've got nothing to hide, what have you to be afraid of? Which is one of the most stupid sayings anyone ever says. Because the point about this is once they've decided they're going to fit you up with some crime, they can find anything. You can remember, as with Martha Stewart, you can lie about something that has no underlying criminal element, and they can get you for it. That's the only difference, really, between Flynn and the way they dealt with Hillary and those people. With Hillary and Hillary's associates, they decided they weren't going to get Hillary on anything. They weren't going to get Huma Abedin on anything. They weren't going to get any of them on anything. So those people had nothing to worry about because it's the decision the FBI makes before they walk into the room that matters. They decided before they walked into the room with Flynn, they were going to get him. So it's not a good faith, honest interview. And if you agree to go along with it, and again, this nonsense that it's not recorded, and even the contemporaneous, so-called contemporaneous notes are made 5-6 months after the fact, as they were in this case, is all the more reason why you should have your own record of what went on. Now, the judge, I love this, the way everyone's, oh, this judge is a really tough judge. He's a fair-minded judge. He doesn't like what Mueller's doing. He may totally quash the conviction. I fell for this line myself. Instead, the judge arrives this morning and goes bananas and he starts accusing Flynn of committing treason. A career military officer, distinguished career military officer, he actually used the T word, treason. I mentioned this with John Oakley the other day. Most people don't even take treason seriously in any part of the Western world. You still have theoretical crimes of treason on the books in Britain, Canada, Australia. Nobody's ever prosecuted under them because we think under multicultural, nobody mind. You can go off and fight for ISIS and you won't be accused of treason. And when you get tired of fighting for ISIS and come back, they'll put you on welfare and they'll give you job training so that you can learn to be something other than just a guy who likes to chop people's heads off. You can be like the Khadr family. You can actually be not just giving aid and comfort to the Queen's enemies, but you can actually be a Canadian and be the Queen's enemies. And then when you get captured by the Pakistanis and decide you don't want to spend your time enjoying Pakistani prison healthcare, you can come back to Ontario and get your Canadian healthcare because under Canada's conception of multiculturalism, that means that when war breaks out, you get to choose whether you want to play for the home team or the away team. But Michael Flynn suddenly is the first person in the Western world to be accused of treason in almost within living memory since Tokyo Rose and the Second World War thing and what was the Lord Haw-Haw and those guys. The first person to be accused of treason since that judge made a fool of himself. He then had to take a break and go and lie down in a darkened room with a nice cup of herbal tea or whatever he was having. But it goes to show you can never really tell how these guys will jump. It's an unusual. It's not a judicial temperament this guy demonstrated, and it was slightly odd. So you know, Michael Flynn is in limbo. But this process crime of the FBI shouldn't exist. It shouldn't exist. Get rid of it. These guys are out to destroy Trump, and they've actually had some success in destroying him. So you're going to just sit there and take it, or you're going to actually push back and do something that would make a difference, like getting... Why don't we get an attorney general or a head of the FBI? This Christopher Wray guy, who's supposed to be in charge of the FBI, why not just actually forswear this rule, suspend it. So you're not going to get people on it anymore. Robert writes, years ago, I forget where, I remember you quoting shrewd, worried officials from Denmark, Singapore, India and Australia about whether the US itself was up to the job as laid out in America alone. I think it was either in National Review, The Spectator or The Telegraph. Do you remember the article and do you have any further comments? I think actually this arose initially out of a comment that Go Chok Tong made. He was the Prime Minister of Singapore from when Lee Kuan Yew retired in 1990, I would say. And he was there until the early years of this century, Go Chok Tong. And he was a very smart and savvy guy. And he said the issue is US will, US credibility. And it was a very sharp observation to make at the time he made it. It became sharper, I think, as the years went by. When you have a nation that is like dithering around in the Hindu Kush ineffectually for 17 years, the question of will is always central to everything. You know, war is not won by the guy with the best tanks. It's won by the guy with the most will. And that is certainly been demonstrated in Afghanistan. But it developed in the Obama years, a broader context. People used to talk about, in the Obama years, the post-American world. You heard that phrase. I heard it in Australia. I heard it from prominent Indians. Where's the other place you met? Oh, yeah, Denmark. Yeah, I heard it from Danish parliamentarians. You began. It's a shocking phrase in a way, the post-American world, and yet for a while in the Obama years, it wasn't shocking. And Robert wants to know: do I have any further comment upon that? Well, I think it's fair to say that America is back on the world stage in a way that it wasn't in the Obama years. But there is, you know, this nonsense with Russia, for example. When Russia is a power in steep decline, now you can be a totally incompetent state and still cause mischief. North Korea is a very good example of that. You can imagine, you know, Sudan would still be a basket case if it had nuclear weapons, but if it could just like randomly lob things out of Khartoum and accidentally hit Cyprus or Greece or wherever, it would still be a threat. A failing, flailing power can still be a threat. But the issue remains China, the rise of China to global economic dominance in a way that would be unlike any global economically dominant power since the Industrial Revolution began. Totally unlike Britain, totally unlike Germany, totally unlike the United States. So the change that happened when the United Kingdom's global dominance was succeeded by America's is not going to be the same as America's being succeeded by China. And that is still a live possibility. And so in that sense, there is still a post-American world that's out there the day after tomorrow that people should be very concerned about. Tom Brook writes, "Hey, Mark, one of the main reasons we are told we need more immigration is because diversity is a strength. My question is, how much diversity do we need before we can say we have enough?" Well, if diversity is our strength, Tom, you can never be strong enough. So you can never have enough diversity. Diversity is not our strength, unless by strength you mean like those dinosaurs who had like huge bulked up bodies and very tiny little brains. That's the diversity cult. Diversity is a weakness. Societies need something in common, to hold them together. That's why we have phrases like common sense, because common sense is only possible in a society which believes certain things in common, that they hold certain things in common. So people have less and less in common, then they will have less and less common sense. And that's what you see in today's world. For example, not just with reference to the accommodations made to Islam or the accommodations made to transgendered grade schoolers, but in all kinds of other ways. A society in which you have more and more diversity means you have less and less social trust, because you don't really know your neighbours anymore. You know all the sort of heartwarming clichés about them. There was a little bit of that when I was debating Simon Sharma in the monk debate in Toronto, where he kept going on about his delightful Muslim newsagent that he buys his newspaper from every morning. He, you know, I'm sure the chap is perfectly pleasant, but Simon Sharma doesn't know anything about him, except when the guy, he says, I'll have a copy of The Guardian, and the guy says, oh, that'll be a quid 25 or whatever it is. And other than the more diversity you have, the more tribal you become. And that's true of all society. I mean, even super multicultural societies that I quite like, and I quite like going hither and yon, enjoying the remnants of, like the Habsburg Empire, for example. The Habsburg Empire fell apart because in the end, once Emperor Franz Joseph had gone, there wasn't actually enough to hold it together. It's a huge experiment, this, that's going on. This idea that nation states, I mean, it's a complete opposite in a century. For example, a century ago, progressives like Woodrow Wilson wanted to break up the great European empires and have ethnic statelets instead. They thought that the Czech people were entitled to their own country. The Poles were entitled to their own country. All these, the Hungarians should have their own. The idea of a huge, great, multi-ethnic, multicultural empire was the opposite of what the progressives believed in. They wanted everybody to have their own nation state. And now in 100 years, we've completely reversed course to say that basically anyone who can get to America is American. Anyone who can get, there's no test anymore. All you have to do, the world, the 6.5 billion people in the world who aren't American or who aren't Europeans are basically just Americans in waiting. They're Swedes in waiting. They're Danes in waiting. If they can get there, they can be as American or as Swedish or as Canadian or as Danish or as Australian as you or me or anybody else. And that's simple rubbish. And the strains of it, when is diversity too much? When can you say we have enough diversity, which is Tom's question? The point is, you won't be able to say that you have enough diversity until you actually have too much diversity and it's too late. In other words, if they don't actually get a grip on this soon, then the big thing is going to be civil war in some of these places. Michael Seth says, Mark, now that we deplorables face a federal government unconstrained by the Constitution or even common decency, and we know that any future federal elections will only be respected if the approved outcome is the result, what the hell are we supposed to do now? I no longer feel like a citizen of this once great country, and I'm not even sure I want to be one anymore. Plus, I look awful in a yellow vest. Please help. Cheers, Mike Seth, the deep end of the swamp, New Jersey. That's for first of all on these yellow vest things, the gilet jaune, I see some people translate it as yellow jacket, which I think is one of those Marvel superheroes. I think Ant-Man became yellow jacket, and so in one of these Marvel movies, a summer or two down the line at your multiplex, the yellow jacket will be a glamorous superhero. But right now, he's just a protesting Frenchman in a very naff, as Princess Anne likes to say, a very naff jacket. And that's actually the point there, Mike, that it's actually, that's one of the things I like about it, is that they look so awful in it. They're basically saying, They're basically saying, yes, we're deplorable. We've got no fashion sense. We're not hip. We're not even wearing the sort of edgy black garb that the Antifa guys wear. We're just wearing these stupid yellow jackets that make us look like eyesores in your streets. Because we are reminding you that the eyesores are people. We are the people who elect the government. And we are the people to whom you, the government, are responsible, which is something that has been wholly forgotten. And to go back to what we were talking about earlier, Mike, which is true with both Trump and with Brexit, that the elites are teaching a dangerous lesson here. They're teaching the lesson that elections don't matter because the people who vote in elections don't matter. So that if the people who vote in elections are too stupid to understand that it's just a bit of sort of ritual, it's just a bit of theatre, then they have to be reminded by having their electoral choices utterly destroyed, as people are trying to do both with Brexit and with the Trump administration. And you will know the question about what you're supposed to do now if large numbers, if millions and millions and millions of people actually get the lesson of that, that if you vote the wrong way, your vote will just be ignored and subverted. I don't know. I'll put it this way. I agree with Ann Coulter that I think Trump is the last chance. And that's why people took a flower. You don't vote for Trump if you don't vote for a guy like Trump. If you're in normal political times, if we were in normal political times, you would vote for Jeb Bush and you would vote for Marco Rubio. You would vote for some cookie cutter mainstream political guy, and he would preside over a generally benign regime that tinkered about with a little bit of micro regulation here and a tax cut there, and nothing was any big deal. And he wouldn't, you weren't looking for a big transformative president because you were basically happy with your life. Millions and millions of Americans are not happy with their lives. They're downwardly mobile, which is downright un-American. It's not supposed to be that way. America is the land that exists because who your grandfather was does not say anything about who your grandson's going to be. All things are possible. So if you have downward mobility, you're basically saying there is no America. There is no America. If succeeding generations live worse lives than previous generations, there's no point to America. And that's why people turn to Trump. So instead of actually sitting back and trying to calculate why millions of Americans felt life was so bloody awful, they were prepared to take a flyer on Trump, instead of actually sitting back and figuring, well, that's on us, isn't it? I mean, we've basically, the middle class is shrinking in America. Middle class wages are stagnant in America. The cost of leading a middle class life, of raising your kids in a middle class environment, is increasing in America. But the people who govern America don't care. Because if you're in one of the counties where government takes place, Washington, D.C. and the immediate county, like the suburban Virginia, Maryland counties, they're booming. So you don't care about all the people beyond the horizon. And that's teaching a dangerous lesson, Mike. We don't know where this goes yet, but I agree with Ann Coulter that it's the last chance. If the wall never gets built, if America, if a president elected on a pledge to enforce the national borders is not permitted to enforce the national borders, then the borders within this society will harden, and eventually those borders will become real, by which I mean, you know, this country will start to break up. We're not there yet, but that's what will happen. Beth, Beth says, last week, the United Nations somehow decided that it takes a two-thirds vote to condemn Hamas terrorists, while it takes a majority to pass just about anything else. Naturally, with a 61-member bloc of Muslim countries, the resolution did not pass. Isn't it time for Israel, at the very least, and other Western countries, including the United States, to pull out of this travesty of an organization and either form an organization of democratic countries or just go their own way? I agree with all of that, Beth. Agree with every single word of it. The United Nations was something that was formed at the end of the Second World War. The Big Five, America, Britain, France, Russia, China, is basically the Second World War victory parade preserved in aspic. At that time, 1945, the big European empires were still mostly intact. So there weren't a lot of countries. There were actually you had in Africa an entire continent governed by the continent to its north, Europe. There weren't a lot of sovereign nations, and we had a massive expansion. 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, the age of decolonization, dozens and dozens and dozens of new countries. And so we now have, as you say, a 61-member, the OIC, the Muslim bloc, that votes as a bloc. Now, you just imagine that. If people were saying, oh, well, if, say, European countries voted as a Christian bloc, with the exception of Albania, people would think that was very odd. But the idea that you can have a third of the membership of the United Nations voting as a Muslim bloc, this is going to get more and more difficult for things like we saw it with the migration thing just signed in Morocco the other day, that these things, we're always told they don't mean anything, and then you find out 2, 3, 4 years down the line that in fact they do mean something. So, for example, the OIC wants, in effect, to institute a new blasphemy law, making it essentially a planetary prohibition on criticism of Islam. And you say to yourself, that's completely ridiculous. They've got a third of the membership of the United Nations already. They don't have to turn a lot of other members before they would actually have a majority there, the United Nations. And by turn, I don't mean that these guys would actually even particularly have to believe it. You just have to get, say, enough Western European countries feel it might be a good move just to tamp down the restlessness of their own Muslim populations. And suddenly you'd have a majority. There's no point to the UN anymore, but people are wedded to, when you say UN to people, they don't think about these corrupt, sleazy, they don't think about, for example, UN peacekeepers, which is basically just enables people, soldiers, to go to various parts of the world and gang rape children. UN peacekeepers are among, UN peacekeepers basically look on the planet as Rotherham. They don't, that's how they do it. Or they go to, they'll go to Haiti and introduce further disease in a humanitarian mission. They'll actually introduce more disease to the place. But people don't think of it like that. People still think when you mention the United Nations, they think of some UNESCO benefit with Audrey Hepburn. There's always a time lag between the image or something. But I'm with you. People need to tell the truth about the UN, and until people are ready to just give up on it, then you have to actually make sure it's completely impotent on everything that matters. Toby Pilling writes, Romaniacs in the UK demand a second referendum to overturn Brexit, a people's vote. But what does that make the initial referendum, a penguin's vote? No, again, it gets to this. That's the European Union model, Toby, where you've seen this in the referenda they've held in on the continent over the years, where people will give the wrong answer. And so then they'll hold another referendum until they give the right answer. In fact, Jean-Claude Juncker, who is the head honcho there in and used to be the foreign minister of Luxembourg, and I think the prime minister of Luxembourg for a while. And when he was either foreign minister or prime minister during one of these referenda on the so-called European constitution, he actually summed it up well. If he said, if the people vote no, we say we continue. And if they vote yes, we press on. In other words, it doesn't make any difference. They're going to do what they're going to do. And that's actually, again, the same thing that people did after the Trump vote in November 2016. Doesn't matter what you do, it's like inevitable. Politics now, it's the great course of human history. The arc of human history bends toward, to modify that tedious quote that Obama's always using all the time, the arc of history bends towards wherever the progressives were planning to go anyway. They're actually naked in their contempt. The people voted to leave the European Union only because they're too stupid. But now we've explained to them how stupid they are, this time they'll vote the right way. I don't think so. There's no need for a second referendum, but if they were stupid enough to have one, it would be to leave again by a bigger margin. Scott Scherzer writes, "Dear Mark, do you think that any Republican can be elected president in the next 25 years? It seems to me that the only reason Trump was elected is because he was as non-traditional Republican as possible. The rest of the party seems about as out of touch as ever," says Scott from Miami Beach. You're right, and I said this at the time. I did a big, I think it's there somewhere on at Stein Online. I did a comparison of, I believe it was the 2000 election, was it? And 2008 and 2012, something like that. The Karl Rove strategy was to divide America into blue and red states. And you had this big Republican voting bloc running south down the mountain states, down the Rockies, and then east through the south and out to the Atlantic Ocean. And in 2000, that was Karl Rove's plan, the architect, as Sean Hannity calls him. And it seemed like genius. Everyone thought he was clever. When you look at that L in 2000, Bush lost New Mexico. So it was only the four electoral votes in New Hampshire that put Bush into the White House. Then you look at 2008, John McCain, and then you're already beginning, again, you're beginning to see the L getting nibbled away. Then you look at 2012, even more nibbled away. So the mountain states, Colorado is going blue. New Mexico going blue. Arizona is all a bit iffy. Nevada all a bit iffy. Then you go to the south and you go to the mid-Atlantic states, and Virginia's suddenly gone from being a red state to a purple state and then a blue state. So the L has all been, the heel has fallen off the L and the toe cap has fallen off the Karl Rove L. And that is what would have happened had the Republican primary electorate nominated a Jeb Bush or a Ted Cruz. Doesn't really matter who you pick, John Kasich, anybody on that spectrum of normal Republican, from Kasich to Rubio to Cruz to Jeb Bush to whoever you want to say, would not have been able to hold that big red L together because too many of those states had purpled. The only way Trump won was by staging basically a hostile takeover of the Republican Party and running essentially as an independent. And now you look at what happened in those midterm elections. You had extreme, not moderate Democrats, not Southern Democrats, not Democrats pretending to be Republicans. You had explicitly, avowedly socialist Democrats who came close to defeating Ted Cruz in Texas and who came close to denying the Republicans Florida, and in many places, such as Arizona, actually did win. And you can't beat that. the way this stupid, monumentally stupid party is doing. Because you're up against... Oh, and Orange County in California turned blue. It's all demography. It's all... People talk about Ronald Reagan's California, Richard Nixon's California, as if it's a thing. It's not a thing. It's in the graveyard. It's pushing up daisies. It's 6 feet under. It's pining for the fields. There's no such thing. When you have demographic transformation of a kind you've seen in California, then eventually Orange County will succumb too, and you got nothing. And that's what's happening in, as I mentioned, Memorial Hospital. I think it's the biggest hospital in Dallas, where 3/4 of the births are anchor babies. And I first mentioned that, whatever it was now, you know, 10 years ago, maybe even 15 years ago. And so all those anchor babies I was talking about then are sort of finishing up middle school now. So they're going to be in the voting booths in another couple of election cycles. And then what are your chances of holding Texas as a red state? And once that's happened, no Republican gets elected nationally ever again. It's over. But the stupid party, congratulations, Chamber of Commerce Republicans. Congratulations, Open Borders Republicans. Congratulations, Paul Ryan. You got a couple of decades of cheap labor out of it. You killed your party. You killed small government. You killed conservatism, but at least your donors got a couple of decades of cheap labor out of it. What a boob. What an idiot. How short-sighted do you have to be? How short-sighted do you have to be? George Pereira writes, government shut down. At best, about 15% of non-essential agencies shut down. And that only if the shutdown of the non-essential agency costs more than keeping it open. Beside, the government largely shuts down every weekend and holiday, and the Republic somehow survives. Absolutely. All this talk about government shutdown is a complete... The idea of this cliffhanger we have now. Oh, will they have to come back? Will they get to go home for Christmas? Will they have to come back and vote to keep the government open? Nobody cares. Makes no difference. The only thing that happened in the last big government shutdown in the Obama years was that the National Park Police turned into some crazed Stasi and coned off Mount Rushmore and insisted that it was now illegal to park on the side of the road and take a picture of Mount Rushmore. There's no reason to do that. It cost them actually more money to send out people to cone off Mount Rushmore and try to prevent people parking on the side of the road and taking photographs of it. It's a racket. It's theater. And this whole thing that politics is lame, pointless dinner theater. I used this statistic on Rush on Monday, and it's fascinating. 86% of federal government spending just happens. Nobody in Congress, nobody anywhere has a say about it. $3.2 trillion just sails through automatically, like a credit card renewal. That you've taken out a subscription to something or other, and every year they just recharge you the thing. The difference is nobody has ever just been automatically charged $3.2 trillion in human history until the federal government of the United States came along. The non-discretionary spending, the only thing Congress actually argues over, debates, discusses, votes for, is actually chump change. It's peripheral. It's $500 billion, which in the course of the federal budget is actually chump change. It's not quite a rounding error, but it's getting close to being just a rounding error. Until you can get control of the 86% that America's citizen legislators have no control over. A lot of this is why people ask me occasionally, I get asked this a lot, why am I not interested in this or that House seat or this or that Senate race or this or that, aspect of Beltway, the kind of Beltway carnival, the Beltway theatre? Because it's not about anything real, you know. Why? Who cares about squabbling? Who cares about the arithmetic of the House of Representatives if they don't control 86% of federal spending? Nobody knows. You know, nobody controls it. You can't go anywhere and vote out anyone on the basis of that 86%. There's no polling station you can go to where you can vote for anyone who can impact that 86% of federal spending. So what's the point of getting hung up on electoral politics? You might as well be watching Ant-Man versus Iron Man. That's how real it is. That's how real it is. Nicola Timmerman, right. Nicola Timmerman. Nicola, by the way, came on the first Mark Steyn cruise. It was a big sellout, the Mark Steyn cruise. And Nicola and her husband came on there. And we had such fun. We're having a second cruise, which we were on the East Coast for the first cruise. So now we're on the West Coast of Canada, as it were. We're going sailing from Vancouver up to through the Inside Passage of Alaska to Glacier Bay. So we'll have done the East Coast. We went from Montreal to Boston. Then we're doing the West Coast, Vancouver to Alaska. So then we'll do the North Coast. And we'll do the Northwest Passage for our third cruise. I promise you. You can take that to the bank. Nicola writes, wondering how the yellow vest movements in Canada can avoid being co-opted by the leftists and anarchists as in France. Any suggestions for a leader? So far, former Saskatchewan Premier Brad Wall is mentioned a lot, but not sure if he is available. Trudeau is in Edmonton, Alberta tomorrow, which should be fun. Yeah, it's interesting to me. Because you see it with Antifa in the US, and it will certainly be similar in Canada. Generally speaking, you know, middle-aged, middle-class people have things they have to do during the day. So they can't go and spend hours on end or the entire night on the streets protesting and rioting. It's hard to get a babysitter for the whole weekend if you're going to burn and riot and loot. And so it tends to be the young left that get to do that. You've had exceptions to that. The Tea Party, for example, was a largely middle-class, middle-aged phenomenon in that sense. That's why when they held a protest, they left the streets cleaner than they were before they began protesting. And actually the French, you can say a lot of things about the French, but the French are some of the most effective working class and middle class protesters anywhere in the developed world. Like there, you will find French farmers, for example, if they want to shut down a bridge, if they want to shut down a railway line, if they want to shut down a highway, are serious about doing that and are willing to do that in prosecution of their own interests. And that brings us back, in fact, to Mike's point earlier. You know, at some point we're going to have to see serious, that the respectable people are going to have to learn the lessons of protest. Because actually shutting down things, stopping things from happening. I mean, what's happening in Paris is a humiliation for Macron. At the Charles de Gaulle Étoile, the French state actually lost control of the situation there. That's a humiliation for a guy who thinks he's Napoleon, like Macron. And the fact is, if they keep ignoring voting, they're incentivizing this kind of direct action. And that's why it'll be important to see whether effective, normal, productive persons in society figure out a way, not the 33-year-old superannuated gender studies student, but serious middle-class persons, whether they're capable. I wish it wasn't necessary, but you can't keep saying to people, voting is everything, and then saying, well, unless you vote for Trump, unless you vote for Brexit, unless you vote for Orban, unless you vote for Salvini, unless, you know, you can't keep saying that. You can't keep diminishing the value of voting and not expect eventually for middle-class persons, productive persons, to figure out that there's going to be other things. AB43 writes, the reaffirmation of his guilty plea of Flynn's guilty plea reminds me of the show trials during the reign of terror of Stalin, in which decorated generals broken by the NKVD admitted acts of treason that they did not commit, using evidence that was supplied by the Nazis. Flynn reached the breaking point, bankrupt, sold his house. What he needed is not a tweet of Trump, but an assurance that he will... Well, there's two things going on here, AB. First is like the absurd... The process is the punishment. I keep using that phrase about legal things. I first use it with my free speech battles in Canada. But in Canada, you can be in protracted legal battles, and it doesn't cost you everything you have. It doesn't empty out all your bank accounts and cost you your house. In America, litigation does. That's wrong. And that's why the general sclerotic dump of American justice, the fact that the clogged bowels of the American judicial system are a betrayal of justice. There's a reason people say justice delayed is justice denied. You know, all these cliches that we used to have, you don't hear so much anymore. There's a reason they say justice delayed is justice denied. And the reason is that justice delayed is going to cost you more. So it makes a difference whether they schedule your court case in 6 weeks' time and taking the case from soup to nuts cost you $12,000, or if the eventual trial is in fact postponed for 2 years. So seeing it through to the end, instead of costing you $12,000, costs you $7.9 million that you don't have. That's the situation that Flynn was in. Flynn had been a career military officer. Didn't have anything. He doesn't in the scheme. He was a lieutenant general, but he hadn't enriched himself in the way that all these other. Basically, he'd been a lobbyist. He's in trouble for getting mixed up with the Turks, but he'd basically been in that game for 20 minutes. He's lost everything. He lost his house. Lost his savings. And so I'm normally resistant to comparisons with communists and Nazis. But I'll go along with it to this extent, AB, that it is like these NKVD things in that sense. In Stalin's case, broken men admitted to crimes they'd not committed in order to stay alive, or often not even to keep themselves alive, but to ensure... that their wives and families would stay alive. And that's all that this means here. Flynn has admitted to something because he's broke. There's no justice in this. And as I said on Rush, they think they've... Mueller and all this goes back. This is a peculiarly American way of things. It's like the getting Al Capone on tax evasion thing. You use what's necessary. That's why you have essentially fake crimes like mail fraud and wire fraud, so that if you can't get the goods on somebody, you can always get them on, putting something in an envelope and sealing it and putting a stamp on it and all the rest of it. These things are not respectable. And when you do it the way we're doing it at the moment, where you're taking people like Papad, everyone knows Papadopoulos was just in, he's a nobody who got entrapped. Everybody knows with Flynn, they decided to get him and they went into that interview to get him. And you don't just, it's not that you damage Flynn and you screw him over when you do something like that. You also screw justice over. And actually, as I look around, This country is no longer and certainly at the federal level, I'll leave the states for another day, but the federal justice system is really not a respectable system. Matthew McWilliams, I want to make sure we get to this question because I think this is actually an interesting question. Matthew McWilliams says, Mark, I've been listening to you and reading your books and columns for about a decade now. That's your first mistake, Matthew. He says, I'm well familiar with your views on the decline of the West in general and the corruption of Western political institutions. I tend to agree with you on the vast majority of your thinking, but at bottom, isn't the decline of the West and its institutions really a story about the decline of the West's people? In countries with universal or near universal suffrage, you would think that an engaged people would be able to elect on at least a fairly regular basis responsive representatives who would clean up things like the US Department of Justice. Yet most Western governments seem to be completely unresponsive to their populations, with just one glaring exception: welfare programs. Cuts in these programs seem to be the only thing that motivates large populations to mass demonstrations and violence. For example, see the recent demonstrations in France. So perhaps Western governments are responsive to the one thing they know will motivate the people against them. Given that an insufficient number of voters in the West seem able to get similarly exercised about defending their borders or protecting their cultural inheritance, isn't this really an indictment of the people, or at least most of them? I can't disagree with that. I think when you say, for example, defending your borders, protecting, well, let's say you say about protecting your cultural inheritance. It's very hard to get people exercised about abstractions. I happen to care about free speech. And so for me, something like Charlie Hebdo is terrible. To me, and actually it doesn't need to get to that stage, the laws in Canada and Australia, one of which I got repealed and the other which I would still would like to get repealed, but they don't, you can't have big demonstrations in the street about things like that. It's not something, the free speech is an abstraction to most people, and they only mourn it once it's gone, if you're lucky. A lot of people just get used to it. You can see it on any college. The people in their grown adults think it's perfectly normal that there's only one correct point of view on increasingly large subjects. So at some point when, for example, Islamic lobby groups say you shouldn't be allowed to say this and you shouldn't be allowed to say that, to the average 22-year-old on an American college campus, he thinks, yeah, why not? You're not allowed to say you're opposed to gay marriage. You're not allowed to say you're opposed to transgender pronouns. Why shouldn't these nice Muslims get a piece of that action too? And I think the welfare thing transforms the relationship between the citizen and the state in ways that actually make democracy pointless. Because the state becomes a dispenser of baubles, and you vote for the party that you think is the most generous dispenser of those baubles, and you can't really have a Republican government in the American sense ever again, because a republic assumes virtue. Tocqueville understood this very clearly, that you can only have a republic of virtuous men. And by that, I don't mean, you know, you can't include women and you can't include people with various exotic pronouns all of their own. I mean men in the sense of mankind, of people. A republic has to be A real republic has to be a republic of virtuous men. Otherwise, you just get these pseudo-republics like in Latin America, where the strong man buys off the people he thinks he has to buy off, and that is not a real republic. And that is why the natural form of government throughout human history has always been either a benign paternalistic monarchy or a ruthless strongman. Because actually it's very unusual to sustain republican virtue across the generations. It's incredibly difficult. And we have now wholly corrupted that. And because particularly after the end of the First World War, we toppled a lot of monarchies. And you can say a lot of things about the Romanovs or the Habsburgs or the Hohenzollerns, but they're not ideological. They're not ideological authoritarians. The Habsburgs basically are the Habsburgs. They're non-ideological. A monarchy is non-ideological in that sense. The Romanovs are non-ideological. And when you replace monarchical strongmen in the modern era. We've replaced them generally with ideological strongmen. So you have communist strongmen, you have fascist strongmen, you have Nazi strongmen, you have Baathist strongmen. But what they all have in common is that they're big government strongmen. And I think, and again, that's not confined just to the fringes of the map. The European Union, actually, Billy, is an ideological strongman that, again, believes in a kind of big government ideology. And it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. Once people vote for that kind of government rewards them for voting for that kind of government, and you get yourself locked into this death cycle. The character of a people is the most important, this isn't even anything to do with government. If you're looking to move into a neighborhood, if you're looking to go and buy a house somewhere, if you're looking to go move to a town and have your children educated in that town, the human capital is the most important consideration that you make. And when realtors say location, 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 and all that, that's not actually quite the whole story, because you can have an affordable three-bedroom house on a nice lot in town A, and a three-bedroom house in a nice lot in town B. And the difference is, and they might have the same kind of garden, might have the same kind of view from the window, but you'll go for town A because town A still functions, whereas town B is riddled with heroin and meth labs and all the rest of it. It's the human capital. And when you get that on a national, and everybody knows this, the mill has died, the factory's died, guys can't support their families, so the people who came from functioning families, your kids are downwardly mobile, your daughter does some crappy service job, does the night shift at the quickie crap, and the son is a heroin addict. Everyone knows that once that happens, just in a town, how difficult it is to build it back up again. It's the human capital. And the reason for that is because you cannot have a republic presupposes a moral people, a virtuous people. Otherwise, it simply cannot sustain itself. And that is it's a big thought to end on. But Matthew McWilliams is absolutely right, and that is the challenge in the years ahead. That's why the subversion of Brexit and the subversion of Trump is all the more depressing, because the people who voted for Trump, they're not the heroin dealers. They're the guys who live across the street from the heroin dealer, who are watching their house values head south, and who want their kids. They don't want the daughter working at the quickie crap until she figures it's easier just to go on welfare. They want a better future. It was a moral act. Even if you regard all the grab him by the whatever, the Stormy Daniels, believe the worst things you want to believe about Trump, but the people who voted for him did so as a moral act, as a restoration of the virtue of a self-governing republic of citizen legislators. The people who voted for Brexit did the same thing. They understood. They don't care. Even if you don't have the vital ingredients to make your own Mars bar for a few months, they'll bear that burden because it was a moral act. It was the act of a self-governing people. It was literally an act to restore self-government. And that is necessary before anything can change. The character of the people is more important than anything else. I'm an optimist. I'm always an optimist. It's not about majorities. There were no more than a third of the people in colonial America who wanted to set up the republic in the first place. So it's not just a numbers game. But at the heart of it is the character of a people, the human capital. Again, this is why this multicultural thing is such rubbish. It's the human capital. A nation is not an airport gate. It makes a real difference if you've got 100 people at gate 27 It makes a real difference whether they're freeborn peoples or they're just Sudan's leading clitoridectomists. There's a difference. There's a difference. It's not just location, location, location. Human capital is the most important thing. We've still got a lot of other questions, other great questions, and as you know, we sometimes get to them in a follow-up edition of video edition of Mark's Mailbox, and we always like getting the questions that we don't, because it tells us what we need to talk about. But this is the last edition of our Clubland Q&A before Christmas, so let me tell you, I'm going to be on the air basically throughout there. I'm not going to get really much of a holiday, but I thank you especially for asking your questions on our Clubland Q&As, and I send you a special Merry Christmas greeting for doing that. We will return the questions I didn't get to. We will keep them and address them and pick some of them out for a future video edition of Mark's Mailbox. But for now, stay tuned. We got lots of terrific. By Friday, we've got the third of our Christmas tales for our time. This one is one of the most perfect stories ever written. You're not going to miss that. We've got some more Christmas entertainment for you on Saturday and on Sunday. Lots of big Christmas specials coming up at Stein Online, and we hope you tune in for them. And if you would, do give some consideration. If you know someone who likes classic tales for our time, likes a little bit of live music, likes other forms of seasonal entertainment, do consider treating them to a Mark Stein Club subscription this Christmas. Thank you all, and we will see you next time.